see. Well, thanks to the organizers for inviting me. Well, this was my original title. But I realized after some thinking that it would be more dramatic just to call it Narna. And that will make sense in a little bit, though maybe not at the beginning. And that little animation will make sense too, I hope. So before I get into things, I thought maybe people here don't know what this thing, the BioHub, is. I'm at the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub, so I thought I would explain it. So I'll start with the smiling faces of the senior leadership. It's a BioHub is a basic research institute. It's pretty new. I joined in 2018. It's a consortium between, basically two donors, Chan and Zuckerberg, and three campuses, UC Berkeley, UCSF, and Stanford. And so all this level of leadership is from UC Berkeley, UCSF, or Stanford. You can see that the co-presidents there are keeping the donors happy, so that's good for job security. But more than that, it has this crazy ambitious goal. It's grown hugely even since I've been there. It's grown by 50% since I got there in 2018. It's got 120 people at the hub itself. And then there's this kind of halo at the three campuses, which is even larger, perhaps. If you count all the labs, it's funds. So it's kind of an interesting place, and I invite you to come visit me there. It's really a lot of fun. We occupy a big chunk of this building at 499 Illinois Street. If I was in the audience, you would be on the UCSF campus at Mission Bay, and behind the building is the bay, actually. I always wondered why it was called Mission Bay, because it's not necessarily adjacent to the Mission, another neighborhood, and it's But it is on the bay, but there's nothing like Mission, you know, what my Mission Bay. It turns out there was a Mission Bay. It really was a bay. This is Market Street in San Francisco. This is like from 1700 or something. And we're here in the bay somewhere. This has all been, this is from the 19th century now. This is what's called Third Street. Now you see why 3rd Street intersects something like 14th Street, because everything got turned in this neighborhood of San Francisco when they filled in this gap. And we are smack dab right there. So now it all makes sense. This actually is a segue to something else, which is the San Francisco Bay Area is teeming with lots of interesting critters. And if you go back to 1800 or so, you can see it was pretty marshy and swampy, both in the South Bay and in the North Bay. And in fact, this was the area I just showed you. That was a marsh too. Now, you know, presently, it's still kind of marshy in the South and some parts of the North. This is what I showed you. That's all now filled in, of course. And lots of interesting critters can still be found in Alameda County, which is down here, and
Mission Bay was by landfill?
Yeah, it's all landfill, that's correct. And, one of the interesting critters is this mosquito called Culex tarsalis, and there's many Culex species, in fact. Culex as a genus doesn't quite do it justice. There's subgenuses and so on, all under Culex. What's interesting is we are in a collaboration, that is the BioHub's infectious disease group, with the Alameda Health Department, and there are mosquito traps along that area I just showed you in Alameda County, and they find lots of Culex tarsalis there. What we do is we smash them up, and we do next generation sequencing, and basically see what RNA is in the whole organism. And there's lots of stuff in a mosquito. It's got a very robust microbiota, including bacteria and fungus things and viruses and...
Sorry.
Yeah, please.
What's this organism's claim to fame?
Oh, Western encephalitis is one thing. West Nile virus. It's one of the, you know, this I think that's what it's called. This the family, the higher order family, is responsible for lots of mosquito-borne diseases. This is the vector for some of them. Aedes aegypti is another one, which is also in that same family. It would be great to understand what's going on inside this mosquito. Let's focus on the viruses for a second. I put this virus diversity thing here not to say those are inside that mosquito, just to say that there's a huge diversity. But what's coming up when they do the RNA-seq on this mosquito is a huge number of norovirus. How do we know that? Well, we just match in the database, metagenomic database, and you pull up identification of sequence related mapping to norovirus. What's a norovirus? It's not one of these famous ones. At least I had never heard of it. And depending on the mosquito, and which I'm calling the sample here, you can get 30% of the non-host reads. Well, it's quite a large range. But are norovirus. So that's going to be a focus. That's why I said Narna might have been a better thing. So this is an example. This is, for instance, about... This is what matches when you do that search. 3,200 base pairs map to one gene in norovirus. This is an important gene called the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. And one of the most important genes for positive sense single-stranded RNA viruses. This is very interesting because this seems to be the only gene in the entire genome of the virus. And if you look on the Viral Zone, which is a website where you find a lot of things, you'll see this map. Here's the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. That's what RDRP stands for, the 5' and the 3' ends. And you don't see a lot of information about what the norovirus is here. It's not no true virion. Well, what they mean is there's no virus particle that's been identified. No capsid gene, apparently. Not even membrane-associated genes, seemingly. Single-stranded positive sense RNA between 2.5 and about 3 kilobases. Mysterious, right? If it doesn't have a capsid or it doesn't associate with some enveloping mechanism, how is it transmitted, for instance? Why is it in such large numbers? And so on. There's lots of interesting questions. Oh, by the way, the name has nothing to do with Narnia. It just comes from naked RNA virus. Naked because this is all there is, right? It's not clothed by anything, seemingly.
So could you just say, like what are there other contexts for people who found this?
I think I have it in a later slide, but it's... it was first discovered in yeast, in budding yeast. But then it was subsequently found in other fungi, and it was found in insects and arthropods in general, and plants, and plant viruses. You know, I'm saying viruses, when I'm talking about the hosts, of course. So, yes?
How does it get around? How does it infect?
Yeah.
Maybe just getting us off topic, but...
No, these are great questions, and we don't have great answers, but the supposition is that vertical transmission, not horizontal.
So how? I don't mean it that way.
Well, mother-daughter, or possibly mating. Like in yeast, during mating, you could share your virus with the with the partner. Yes.
But in what sense is a virus?
Yeah.
Well, that's a great question. Yeah, why call it a virus? Well, because a virus doesn't need a capsid necessarily.
I just call it something.
Something else, right. Well, maybe this is a little semantic, but I agree with you. It's not clear we know everything about it that we can call it a virus. But there are other non-enveloped viruses, so it's not alone in that respect. It does have special properties that I'm going to get into that I think are interesting, both from the informatic point of view and also from the point of view, let's say, of being an extreme example of what viruses or other life forms can do. Was there another question over here? Yeah, Mike.
Or maybe you're here to talk about this, but do you know if it recombines?
You mean how many segments? Is that what you mean?
Well, that'd be just segregation.
What do you mean with the nuclear genome?
Yeah, I mean you need a multiplicity of infection, I guess.
No, I don't know for sure about that. Yeah, but the early work said there was some connection to the that it hybridized with nuclear DNA, but I haven't seen that actually reproduced.
Greg, do you know where in the mosquito this virus?
Well, we don't have information on that ourselves. Simply smush up the entire organism. So we don't know, for instance, so a priori we don't know if the mosquito is the host or if it's one of the other things in the mosquito that's the host. I will make some arguments later that we know it uses codon table 1. Okay. So you can eliminate certain more exotic possibilities that it uses a different genetic code, for instance, but it seems like evidence is pointing to that it actually does infect mosquito cells, actual cells of the mosquito.
And you do total RNA-seq, or do you do any, mRNA-seq, or direct RNA-seq, or do you reverse transcribe?
They do both total RNA and mRNA. So
you see them both?
Yes.
So it has a poly A tail.
That's a great question. It has, I don't think it's a poly A tail. It's a poly something tail. I can't remember. It has a very distinctive end. Yeah.
Can I ask one other thing? This is not to be obnoxious, just to help me understand where you're going. Is it related to energetics in some way?
Well, I would say more to entropics, maybe, okay, than energetics. Okay. I would say we still don't know, but I picked it as a talk for this meeting because I think it represents a really interesting extreme case where I think lots of theories can be tested at these extremes. Okay. So I'll just say a word about its discovery. It came about, the first clue was in 1971 in this paper where they noted that in yeast, they presented a couple forms of evidence, but this is electrophoresis, polyacrylamide, I guess, and they saw peaks at the parts of the ribosome, but then they saw this 20S, this is the, what's it called, the sedimentation coefficient. So it's related to the molecular weight, of course. So they saw this mystery peak, and then later work, maybe 7 years later, coming out of Haber's lab, and then subsequent to that, a lot of things identified that RNA with what I told you before, basically a long stretch, about 2,500 nucleotide positions in this example. The one I showed was between 31 and 3,200, so there's a range. So there's different Narnaviruses and different genomes. By genome, I mean this one gene now, right? And this, I would say, was actually the point where the initial observation and the discovery collided. So, just so you know, what an RDRP is, it's a rather important thing. This is an example. It's not the one that that I've been talking about in particular. But so the purple here, this is actually a kind of a capsid proteins in the background. But the purple here is the RDRP, and you can see in the center there's kind of a hole, and through that hole is threading the nucleic acid strand. And so everybody who writes about this uses this language of a right hand. That is, take your right hand. They say the structure of this enzyme is got fingers, a palm, and a thumb. And that threading between the thumb and through the palm is the nucleic acid. So that's a cartoon that everyone uses. I think the important thing to note here is that there's a very tight association between the nucleotides and that inner core of the protein there, and that's one way people have identified, new RDRPs is by looking or having clues about them in a naive protein sequence, is that in fact there are residues that are characteristic of being in contact with nucleotides. Was there another question? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
What are these three different types here in the slide?
RDRP is actually represents a class of different polymerases. So what is it doing? It's taking the, it could take single stranded. How does it code for the RNA that it's producing? So RNA dependent RNA polymerase means it takes the RNA and it creates a complementary RNA, but it could do that with a single stranded positive sense, single stranded negative sense, or double stranded. And that's what I meant by the three classes. So in our case, the evidence points to that the Narna virus is single-stranded positive sense. Okay. It's that kind of RDRP. That's what I meant. So this shows how Narna fits in with and phylogenetically with other viruses. And what its closest relatives are. It turns out, based on diagrams like this, there are two broad classes of Narna viruses, alpha and beta. The distances here are 0.4 nucleotide substitutions per site. I'm going to mostly focus on this branch, the alpha, there. And this is the alpha broken down. This answers a question like how widespread are these? What are the hosts and so on? So you can see it's pretty varied. If the Narna that we're seeing comes from the mosquito, it would be in the purple. The initial discovery, you could say, was in this kind of tan one. Another one that people use as reference are often plant viruses and perhaps sometimes algae. Like I said, the initial discovery was this 20S RNA that was discovered. So the one that we're seeing is down here.
And are these guys related to other viruses?
Yeah, that was the previous slide where.
Oh, maybe I misunderstood that. Those ones are.
These are not all Narnas. No, these are all different types of viruses, but Narn is just this red branch.
And so, then all those other guys.
This one here?
No, sorry, this previous one. So then all those other guys, those will have like coat proteins and everything.
Yeah. But some might, but some may be unenveloped as well. But for sure, all these have bigger genomes. This is holding kind of a record for a really minimal genome so far. Even in the Narn viruses, having one gene is not necessarily the case. You could have three different genes. It's possible. Yeah?
So are these the same as viroids?
I don't know that term, but...
Viroids are the smallest infectious pathogens known, composed solely of a short strand of circular single-stranded RNA that has no protein coding.
No, because this does have... That RDRP is really... its homology is very well established. So this is a protein. This does seem to code for an RDRP.
Right, but
I haven't given any evidence that it produces the RDRP.
Like it doesn't have capsid.
No, it doesn't have a capsid, but it's not alone in that respect.
Right. I'm just trying to figure out if it's the same as these.
I don't know. Great question. I don't know the term viroid, but might be reserved for something else. I'm not sure.
Just one other question I might have missed. So is there any evidence that any of the nanoviruses are pathogenic?
Sure. Depending on... yes. So for instance, I think... what's a good example? There's one called Phytophthora, which is a... which infects plants and plant roots, and it's I'm not sure if it's classified in the green here or in the alger one, but it's a
they're all mycetes.
They're all mycetes. Thank you. Yeah. So where's
on Peter's point?
Yeah.
You know that doesn't make it. I don't know what we mean by pathogenic, but you know you carry around some RNA molecule.
Well, it's...
There's bursts and things like that, you know, infectious.
Yeah.
And, you know, bursts.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. So I don't have direct evidence for that, I have to say. It infects pathogens, okay? Let's put it that way, right? Mike was saying, the oomycetes are plant pathogens. For instance, the potato blight, I believe, was caused by... that species I mentioned. So I put this back here because I thought it would be fun to see if I can do this, to actually just copy the RNA sequence. Let's see if I can do it. This is interactive challenge for me. Copy, okay. Then I'm going to go to the XPOSI website, which everybody can use. If I can use it, anybody can use it. I paste it in. There it is. I select, let's say, verbose. I'll look at all. Look at the standard table. You can choose any of those other 30 tables of genetic code. I say translate. Okay, so now I scroll down, and you see if... Now you'll see all six frames that it could possibly translate to. That is, why do I say six? Because you could, on the forward strand, you could have three different shifts, and you could have it on the reverse as well, right?
That's a bad one.
So that's a bad one, yeah.
Stops.
Yeah, that's a really bad one. And then,
ooh.
Voila, right? Now let's go on the reverse.
Bad.
Bad. Okay, next one's going to be bad because it's... Oh, wait a second. It's practically the entire 3,000 stretch. So what is this telling you? It's telling you that there's something weird happening, right? That in fact, there seems to be two genes. One in the positive, in the forward direction, and then on the reverse complement, another one. How is it possible to have a meaningful protein coding gene, that's not nonsense in the other direction. Well, it's possible to do that for some stretches, but possible to do it for over 3,000 base pairs. So,
this is the whole genome of the virus?
That's the whole genome of this Narna virus. Yeah.
So, is the amino acid sequence the same in both directions?
No, it's not a palindrome.
The frame is different, so that you actually have...
Let me get to that, okay? That's a whole part of my story here about what frames are possible, given the phenomenon we're seeing. Okay, so let me... Now, this is going to be...
Can you just scroll back up one more time so we can see the two?
Oh, yeah, sure. No, absolutely. Yeah, good that you mentioned it.
Wow.
Okay, so that's... let's say if this was the... So these frames, I should say, are... this answers Shelley's question. They're lined up first, second, third is lined up with first, second, third in that. So what this is indicating is that the third matches the third in the reverse complement, okay? Now, is that just an accident that they match up? Was it just a one-third chance? I'll get to that in a second.
Do you think that the first one, you have a pretty long open reading frame in that first?
Well,
that's just by chance?
I think it's by chance because you don't, because notice there's no stop codon there. It's just, they just picked up this methionine and said it was an initiator, right? Initiation codon. It may not be. It could just be methionine. That's not...
it's like 150 amino acids. So.
Yeah, I'll show where that falls on a probability density plot. Okay, 150 isn't crazy. So.
Yeah, I know. That's
yeah.
What I'm saying.
Okay.
Is there some mass spec data to know what is actually translated?
Yeah, well, this is early days, okay, so I don't have that yet, okay. That would be great to have. That's a great, very good thing.
So I'm not a molecular biologist by any means, but so how often does this happen, anybody? I mean, if you go forward and backward?
I'd be interested in the answer, but I will address that too, okay.
All right, okay.
But if anyone knows...
Comment. So we looked at every single viral genome. This is in a paper that Gita wrote in my group, and 15% is multiplexed.
Okay. 15% for
both of them.
That means some overlap. Is
some,
that right?
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is the p-value for that?
I don't know.
So overlap is common in viruses, but not this kind of overlap, right? You get a spectrum, a probability distribution of overlap lengths.
Greg, just to clear up a basic point, this is a feature of this Narna virus, not of Narna viruses.
That's correct. This is a feature of this one, and it's not in every Narna virus, okay? Which is an interesting point. How do I go back? Let's see.
You blast those two proteins. One of them should be RNA-dependent RNA-P, but what's the other one?
I think the short answer is it's not random in the sense it has some structure, but no significant homology. Okay, I did that part. All right. Let's see. So this is the picture that we have for this particular one. As Sri pointed out, not every Narna virus has this feature of the large reverse ORF, okay? Open reading frame, ORF. So we decided to take this phenomenon seriously, and we call this phenomenon ambergrammatic, based on this word ambergram. That is a set of letters with two orientation-dependent readings. So a classic example is, can people read this, by the way?
Yeah.
And then, okay? That's your classic ambergram, right? It's similar to what's going on with us. We have a reading in one direction and a different reading in the other direction in the reverse complement. I noticed in 2011, ambergram made it to the Oxford English Dictionary along with couch surfing and bet hedging and Barnard's star, which is odd because that was discovered like in 1910 or something. So, So I didn't make it up. It is a real word out there, all right? So someone said, how likely is it in life, but how probable is it naively? So let's do a quick back of the envelope calculation. I won't claim that this is too exact, but let's say that, we have 3 stop codons out of 64. So we'll say that, in fact, the probability of a stop codon is, 1 out of 20, let's say. So 0.05. Well, that's the probability of not having a stop codon would be 1 minus that, which I will write as approximately that. And so now let's say I have n of those, one after another. What's the probability of that? Well, that's simple. We could write it as this number to the power n, which I've done here. And now we plug in. So this n refers to codon positions. So 3,000 base pairs, 1,000 codon positions. I get 10 to the minus 22. So based on this simple back of the envelope calculation, it's extremely unlikely. However, let's not be fooled. Remember the intelligent design argument. This is a thing in the U.S., probably in Europe and other places. You don't have to deal with these people. But they argued, the bacteria flagellum is very unlikely too, and therefore God exists, right? That was basically, in fact, this picture came from their website. This is a intelligent design theorist. So let's not think that just because this number is small doesn't mean there's anything super weird going on. But there is something weird going on, at least because we don't understand how this thing could evolve necessarily. So let me dig a little deeper. I think that calculation was probably not going to satisfy people. So let's just use this notation to talk about those 6 different reading frames, possible reading frames. So by definition, I'll call the reference frame plus 0. And then if you shift it toward the 3 prime end in on that strand, you call it plus 1 for one shift and plus 2 for 2 shifts. You could call this negative 1, but then I'm using the negative for the reverse strand, okay? So the one that lines up with plus 0 is going to be called minus 0, and so on, in analogy with the forward direction. So that's just notation. There's nothing fundamental about it, but I'm going to use it from now on. Okay, so this is like a generic Narna virus that you'll find in yeast. And notice blue marks that large open reading frame for the RDRP. And now you look at all 3 in the reverse direction. Everywhere there's a line or set of lines, there's a bunch of stop codons. Okay, it's just littered with stop codons. There's no large open reading frame in this Narna virus. However, the one that we isolated, this is the phenomenon that you saw when I plugged into XPOSI, right? They're almost the same length, except for just a little difference here. So this is the phenomenon, right? I think got it. And now this within that same tree I showed you for the alpha Narna viruses. Here's a plot that answers another question I got, which was this color code, the redder it is, the more equal the positive and the negative large open reading frames are. So basically, pure red could be 1, that is the ratio of those lengths is exactly near 1. Black would mean 0. So you can see there's big red clusters here and here. And then there's some funny things which are somewhere in between, and there's lots of black. This one here, Wendling 7, there's a bunch of Wendlings. But Wendling 7 is interesting. It's somewhere right in the middle there. You can see it's not quite red and not quite black. That'll come up in a second, but the other thing I want to note is the distance between these viruses, of which the one I've been talking about is this cool X here, and the ones down here, it's large, actually. It doesn't mean that this is some oddball that maybe evolved once and then and it's just a little peculiar corner. It evolved again. So this suggests that there's something going on, some reason, if you like, that there is this ambigrammatic feature. And I do think of it like a feature, even though it's not a phenotypic, not traditionally phenotypic. You could say it's a genomic feature. It's a feature of the genome. So what is it? Why is it important that there be this unusual, very high density compression of information, if that's what it is? And why would such a thing be stable? How would such a thing even arise? Yeah.
I would like to know exactly what you mean by distance large. So are there a lot of synonymous substitution, because you still have the same protein which takes the whole genome?
What I'm saying is that these sequences and these are not necessarily very close to each other, and it's not just non-synonymous that the distance between them is large.
Since what thread encodes the same protein.
I'm sorry, Matt, not just synonymous. Yeah, say again.
So since one strand encodes the same protein,
yeah,
and it takes the word sequence.
Yeah, but same protein. These proteins are in the same class, but they're not. They don't have sequence identity.
But it's mostly synonymous substitution, or they're really different?
No, they're really different. They can be different. Yeah, like, there can be synonymous, of course. Yeah.
And is the other or by the other, is that similar between that guy and between the two?
No, it's going to be just, because of complementarity, it's going to be just as distant, right? Well, once I know the forward, I know the reverse, right? That's why I called it a double-dealing nucleotide, right? Because if it makes sense in this direction, it also, now I just use base complementarity, I know what the reverse direction is, right?
Right. So, but
okay. Maybe I'm misunderstanding your question.
No. I mean, so like, this encoding for two different things.
Yeah.
Is it so like?
Yeah, but we don't know what the second thing is.
Yeah. So, yeah. But is the amino acid sequence of the second thing similar between these two different groups? In other words, like, does it look like it's a? Does it look like this other guy is coding for a similar thing to the top guy, or a totally different thing?
Yeah, I think.
The anagrammatic proteins in the two red classes, homologs.
Yeah.
What kind of one?
So we don't have a protein. We have a putative protein in the reverse ORF, right? We don't have a known reference protein. Right, you could say you could look at the non-synonymous distance, right, and divide it by the synonymous distance, and that does show a difference between the reverse and the second. I think that's what you're getting at, right?
But if you just
go ahead.
If you just did a pairwise alignment of the two protein sequences, do they look anything like each other? For your reverse,
the non-RDRP.
Your putative proteins.
No, they don't. They're 30% identity or something like that.
Can give you the same structure and function, actually.
30% could. Yeah,
but it's possible. But it's not the same sequence solution.
They're not.
They didn't sort of evolve the same sequence solution. Those are pretty independent.
That's correct. What's common is the ambigrammatic feature. That's
like, you can get to that anagrammatic feature in two different in different sequence ways.
Yes, that's the point of this.
Yeah.
That's one of the messages of this plot.
So could you just making the host tired and making it junk?
That I'll come back to that. It's a hypothesis, right?
So it seems like you could do a really cool experiment by taking that reverse reading frame and putting in a stop codon that would be synonymous in the other direction.
Yeah.
And then seeing whether this thing is still as infectious.
Yeah, right. Right. Well, Wendling 7 looks like that, even though that's not an experiment, it's just an observation. Wendling 7 looks like you've scattered a couple random stops in a previously or perhaps future large reverse orth. Yeah.
So if I understand this correctly, in both cases it's the 0 and the minus 0 that are...
What I've shown you so far, yes.
So that means that to get to that place, to sort of fix the stop codons, substitutions on that strand are non-synonymous substitutions on the other
strand.
That's what
our game is going to be about.
Okay.
That's why everyone has
a... So that's just crazy. Like a lot
You people are too fast. I can't get... Any surprises? You've anticipated the...
Sorry, can I ask another question?
Talk. Yeah, please.
maybe you can learn something by looking at the first and second position, because the first position is the wobble position.
Yes, right.
Am I anticipating or...
Yeah, you are. I mean, that's great intuition. So okay. So let's I stuck this one in just to show you that what Wendling 7 looks like. So here's the one I showed. The Phytophthora infestans virus, the one that infects Phytophthora culex, which I've been talking about, and then Wendling 7, in this same minus zero frame, you just see it's kind of like what Shelley was saying, you know, just insert a stop codon in this big thing. Of course, we don't have any time information here. We don't know if they're coming or going.
What is Wendling?
Wendling's a place in China.
Oh.
You mean what's
the host?
All of these are the host's names, right?
Well, that's why I'm asking, what is Wendling?
Well, you know, there's like Hubei viruses, there's Wendling viruses. They're just names of...
What's the species that's the host?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I'd have to Google. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Definitely not Hubei. It's not Hubei. It's a place.
Person name.
No. There's a whole bunch of viruses named after a place in China, and then some number, right? Lots of Hubeis, lots of Wenlings.
That's where they find them.
That's where, perhaps, where they find them. Well, yeah. What's the host? I haven't really given you any evidence that even the mosquito is the host, right? So that's a mystery. Okay, so let's ready your
original question.
Yeah, please.
So energetics.
Yeah.
So what you have is something that's cut the cost of DNA in half. Right?
Yeah. 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 I'd say that's one. Yeah, that's a great point. I don't know what to do with it right now, though. Sorry. Very good point. Okay, we're going to use this table in a second. I get it ready. So let's review a little bit. I gave you both. I didn't know which one was easier for people to use. From my own point of view, I like the wheel on the one side, but some people like the matrix on the other. I apologize. I don't know why this slide still has the T's. I thought I changed them all to U's. But notice, for instance, a typical stop. Well, let's just on the board. You have. United Asparagus Association, that's how I remember it. United Association of Asparagus Growers. You have United Growers of Asparagus, right, okay. So that's, that's, as you can see, exactly what I have up there. Now, what are the reverse, let's assume that we're in the 0 plus, 0 minus. Okay, that's just that's not necessarily always the case, but it is matched some of the observations. So then I would map to leucine, and serine. If you look at your table, whichever one you like. Okay, that's interesting. Because there's lots of synonyms for leucine and serine. So that, first of all, that's a very interesting point right there. Secondly, and this is some of the same information, if I look at all 64 possible combinations, what I see is, in fact, so this is the percentage of amino acids observed. And you'll notice it's very strange. Well, I mean, it's kind of equivalent to what I said, but still I think strange, that three are exactly zero, right? That's equivalent to the observation that there are no stops in the reverse complement, right? So these two leucines never appear. The serine never appears, right? Because this is what I'm reading in the forward direction, and it has to map to no stops in the reverse complementary direction.
This is percent of amino acids in this.
That's
protein,
correct.
Not all proteins. In this particular protein.
In the sequence, yeah. Not all proteins. No, just for this very simple plot. Okay. This suggests a certain kind of thing we could do in the forward frame, which is related to my game, which we're going to do. So this is the observation I just said. Oh, here's where I fixed it. Okay, I fixed it on the wrong slide. If they're aligned, we see that stops would map to one stop to leucine, another stop to leucine, one to serine. But because of the abundance of synonyms for leucine and serine, I can always, let's say I had a stop, I can always find a synonymous substitution that would give me another leucine or give me another serine. So that's, so in agreement with the observations, it seems that having the reverse, if I require that I can always remove stops through synonymous substitutions in the other direction, then it's fine to have them aligned. Okay, but that's not an argument against the other shifts, it's just an argument that this one's okay. But now what we could do is we could look at the...
I don't know if this really is going to matter for our game, but the first one is an isoleucine, the AUC.
And the second one...
Oh, did I make a...
And the second one is also, it's still a redundant one, so I don't know if that's the important part.
Yeah, okay. It's not going to matter because it's redundant. Okay, thank you. All right, so... let me keep going. Let's consider staggering the frames. So there's three different ways I can stagger the frame. Let's consider the negative one staggering. That is, in the reverse complement, I shift toward the 3' direction by one. And this is an example, but it's a carefully rehearsed spontaneous example, okay? So I want to consider this particular example, and I'll show you that it will obstruct the mechanism that I mentioned in the case when they're zero aligned, okay? So look up in your table, UA and then a wild card. Okay, so using either which way you like, if I go UA and a wild card, you'll see I have tyrosine. Okay, and I have a possibility of a stop codon.
Right.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I was saying it is losing because you're reading it from 5 to 3 always.
CUA.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification. I've studied it many times, but I'm still make mistakes all the time. So
you are right.
Okay, thank you. I wasn't going to make a big point about it. All right. So UA wild card is either a stop, obviously we have some stops here, or it's a tyrosine. Now, that is, there's nothing I can change here that's going to avoid getting this. This is a stop, right, in the other direction. There's nothing I can change here because it's always tyrosine, and it's not going to change the U and A, so there's no synonym that's going to help me get rid of this. So that's okay. Let's focus on this one now. Okay? That means there's nothing I can do over here that's going to help. What about the C here? Well, clearly I want to change the C. Okay? But these are wild cards, so I have a lot of freedom there, you would think. But it's not really true, turns out. So I want to change the G, but I can't change it to an A, right? Because that would put me in this stop. So that only leads me to change it to a U or a C, right? Okay, so a U or a C, that's okay, but that would map to what? An A or a G up there, right? Okay, so I want to change the C to an A or a G, but yet keep the identity of that. I want this to be a synonym. So now, so I find it easier to do this with the wheel, but others may differ. Let's see if that's possible. So what I'm going to do, if you're on the wheel, I'm going to start with alanine. Alanine are roughly at the 10 p.m. position. And I'm going to circle the C on the outer rim of the wheel. This is going to be like Sudoku, right? Except now with a circle. Or if you're using the matrix, it's more like Sudoku, I guess. Okay, so we're in luck. That's great. Look, I can jump. Remember, I'm always jumping from C to A or G. I can jump to an A and G, and I stay within alanine. Yeah. That's great. Yay, I'm done. Okay, but now I have to do it for everything because my requirement is that these are arbitrary. I want this to work in every single case. That is, I want to always be able to remove a stop codon in this particular frame. So okay, alanine's checked off. Now I look at aspartic acid. I circle the C, which is just under the D code. And now if I jump to A and G, I have a problem. I have to switch to glutamic acid. Now, yep. That's okay if there's another way I can get glutamic acid. If there's another way I can get aspartic acid. That's what I started with. That was my C. But if you look around the periphery of the diagram, there is no other aspartic acid. So I'm stuck. That's an obstruction. That crossing of boundaries along the circular rim is a problem for that particular case. And if I go through, let's take another example. How about glycine? Okay, I circle the C in glycine. This is at the 11 o'clock position. The C, and I jump to A and G. Hey, that works great. Fine. I have to move on to phenylalanine. Okay, I have a problem with phenylalanine. I circle the C, and when I jump to A or C, I cross into leucine. Yeah. So this is like a Sudoku puzzle, which the designer didn't do it right, because there's no way to complete. There's no way to get to my goal. If the goal in Sudoku is to fill in all the things, I can't do it here, because I'm obstructed. And if you go around the whole thing, somewhere I did this, you can check the ones that work and the ones that don't, and unfortunately get lots of obstructions. There's no way to play the game that I specified with this particular shift. And the same thing is true, I could go through it, but same thing's true with the minus two shift. Different argument, of course, and I've chosen a carefully pre-selected spontaneous example just off the top of my head, but that won't work. And you can, this one's easy. Maybe one way to see it is if you do UUU. Is that the one I want? Yeah, UUU is phenylalanine. That's one example that you can see just leads to an obstruction there. And there's others. So this Now going back to someone's observation, are you really required to be in that 0-0 shift? And the claim is, yes, the 0 reading frame is the only frame whereby, according to the rules of my game, you can eliminate all the stop codons using synonymous single nucleotide substitutions. Okay. All right, so that's interesting, because this kind of, I was saying before, this Amber Grammatic thing with the zero shift is sort of a genomic feature or trait. This shows it has a really kind of fundamental informatic quality to it, which is forced on you by the a certain argument, right? Okay. So I would say the answer to this question is yes. Reverse ORF is surprising. This isn't the greatest set of axes, but I'm just showing you this because Narna is, where is Narna here? It's right there. Narna is really unique so far in this observation. The problem with the axes is one is logarithmic and one is linear, so it doesn't quite, it shows Narna in a corner. It doesn't show you quite how extreme it is. That is, there's other viruses, some DNA viruses show large overlapping regions, but they're much bigger. This one's 100 times bigger than Narna, right?
So that's why I said that. Are you talking about genes on opposite strands or just?
No, this is
not the same strand.
Sorry, this is on opposite strands. I don't know if you can have on the same strand too. That's another phenomenon. I'm not going to discuss it. I can't remember if some of that was put in this plot. Was there another question? I believe it was Rob who said something about having 150-ish overlap. So here's a nice thing that Hannah Ritalik, who's a very terrific graduate student who's been working on this, did. She jumbled known RDRPs and then looked at the statistics of overlaps, and what she found, well, this was for 42 different known Narna viruses, and this is the actual, so that's, if you like, well, this is the actual, the dots are the actual things in this kind of Poisson-like distribution is coming from the jumbling. What you'll see is that, in fact, the only cases where you get these extremely long, again, this is in the amino acid positions, the extremely long ones are in the 0 plus and the 0 minus. So 150 nucleotide positions would be equivalent to 3 times that. So that'd be about 300 or so. So that would be right at the end of this tail. I mean, right at the end, somewhere around there. Sorry, did I do it the wrong way? I said I did do it the wrong way. I want to divide. Sorry, 50. Thank you. So it would be in there somewhere. It's not very surprising, right? So my point is things around here up to some point are expected, but overlaps there or not. Okay.
I want to comment on what I was saying earlier, which is if you look at the distribution of protein links,
yeah,
it's very common to have 150 amino acid proteins. So
okay.
You're arguing against, but I'm arguing for.
I see. Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah, point noted. Thank you. This is just showing in that ARFA, this in the alpha and Narna viruses, where those, it's not all the alpha Narna viruses. You'll see this is a little cartoon, you could say. Red means that overlap. And the other ones don't have it. So it's something that is a phenomenon, right? That's what I'm arguing here. And this is the showing the identity matching.
Identity with whom?
Well, between these two, for instance. 35% identity, for instance. That's not great. I mean, that's not super high, but it doesn't mean that they're not coding for similar or same protein, right?
Can you compare the identity of the gene in the forest line with the other,
yeah, that's extremely low, but I don't recall the figure.
So this is for the forward one, for the polymerase?
This is for the forward, yeah.
Okay.
That's for the RDRP?
Yes, yeah. So, all of those plots were based basically on RDRPs.
Okay.
All the maximum likelihood trees. Sorry, I went backward. Okay, so what's the reverse dwarf's functional relevance? Unfortunately, I don't have a great answer for this. All viruses are very diverse, but they share some common constraints, and the constraints are they need to be translated. Their genetic information needs to be translated. They need to avoid getting degraded, and sizes, there's some pressure on the size. Yes?
So while we are playing this game, is there any reason why we've restricted access to viruses?
No, but I have in my talk. Yes, it's true. No, but we don't. I guess this gets to the broader issue of how general this phenomenon is. What does the phenomenon actually represent, other than it's the bare fact that it's an ambigram, right?
But given this guy's lifestyle, why is there a concern on the genome size?
Well, in this case, we don't know, right? But I'm speaking very generally. There might be a constraint on its genome size. Without any evidence that it's enveloped, and this supposition that it's not transmitted horizontally, but primarily vertically from mother to daughter, it's not clear what role this would have. Yeah, exactly right. But if you have a capsid, you have to get into the capsid, and there can be consequences of having long length.
Great. RDRPs are really error prone. So, what's the consequences?
Some
are synonymous, but then they're not synonymous.
Yeah, I don't have a very sophisticated calculation of that. Just one that's kind of at the level of that first back of the envelope thing. But clearly, the available, evolutionary space is incredibly circumscribed, right? And that it's incredibly shrunk. As a quick estimate, if you say my space of possibilities should be like 20 to the length, the number of codon positions, clearly this constraint that I was arguing for the 0-0 shift, that you have to find the synonymous, let's say I fix the gene in the forward direction, let's just assume that, and then I'm required to to avoid the stops by finding synonyms, then you could say if there's an average of 3 synonyms, I'm really going down to 3 to the n rather than 20 to the n. This is very crude, of course, but the ratio of that is, as a function of n, is exponential, right? It's almost seven
when you,
to the end, right?
Sequencing reactions, so each one's a single mosquito, or are you just lump? I'm wondering what the polymorphism.
This was discovered originally with five mosquitoes.
So they're mixed together.
Yeah, they're mixed together, but you can do single. But
are you looking at polymorphisms at all, or worrying about that at this point?
Not at this point, but
yeah,
that's
a consensus sequence.
But I think Hannah Ritalik is working on that. I may have a slide that she gave me related to that, actually. So she may have done a little more than I'm thinking on that. Was there another question? Okay.
I'm listening a little like this is not a good idea because if
right.
makes a mistake,
yeah.
you've essentially gotten two hits in your genome.
Right.
If the reverse is functional, which it seems
yeah,
like
it doesn't.
Must be.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so there is a.
So there must be some constraint that is more important than the risk of. Well, I guess if you just make lots and lots of copies, you.
Can you turn on the light?
Yeah. I think what you're saying is if I align my frames, for instance, say these are the three positions in a codon, I have a lot of freedom to wobble the last, so this is in the two direction. I have freedom. I can wobble a lot of. I can change this codon a lot and keep. But that's going to change the first codon in the other direction. So it doesn't seem very stable, right? And I agree with that.
It's a hard way to do things.
It seems like you're entering a really rigid, narrow region of the configuration space. But yet, that is what is observed. So the competition between evolving it and actually, having this phenomenon in the first place and then having it stable to random drift is interesting. Yeah, I don't have a great answer for that.
Should we add a third possibility here? Like,
yep.
I guess I would like to break down important into functional and protein product is not functional, but important in the sense that it's being produced, it's costing energy, it's just exhausting the host.
Yeah, I guess that's not quite the same as irrelevant, and I take what you're saying. But that's sort of what was meant to be captured here. But I agree with you 100%. What if the other hypothetical reverse translated protein is just gumming up the works somehow, right?
But can you just measure it?
Yeah, you could. Well,
this
is what's happening now. Okay, this is.
Okay.
You know, I don't do the experiments myself. I just sit down at a desk, and play with the little pictures. But the experimentalists are trying to create the protein. They're trying to get the virus out of supernatant in infected cell lines. You know, they're not relying on capturing mosquitoes out in the wild. They've got mosquito cell lines, and now they're infecting them with in some cases using plasmids to drive this into the cell. So there is some experimental work on precisely what you're saying, but I don't have the results of that yet, so I don't know.
Okay. I'm just saying this hypothesis is testable.
Absolutely, right. That's why, yeah.
And being tested.
Yeah, no, it's not just it's a scientific hypothesis, right? It can be tested. Right? okay. Here are some obstacles. It's not, there doesn't seem to be significant homology. This is well, this is showing the DNDS values. So this is a measure of the distance. It's a ratio between the non-synonymous and synonymous distances. Well, this is actually a little sobering. These numbers are very different, and this relates to an earlier question. This is completely in the range of what people would say is a protein coding.
Who's to be compared to who? Is that from two different nanoviruses, or?
This was based on more than two, I believe. Yeah, I don't recall how many went into this, but might be the 42 I mentioned before. But but this huge value, well, I'm not sure what it's actually saying. I think it's a red flag, which is saying it could be that this is not translated. Actually, into proteins.
So, but what is DNDS?
This is a measure of the. Probably someone in the audience could say it better, but non-synonymous distance. It's really d sub n, d sub s. It's not a derivative. Okay, it's just a ratio of two distances, and this is the average non-synonymous distance divided by the average synonymous distance. So, if this is small, it means that this is. The non-synonymous, let's say the pathways you can get in changing codons is through that go through non-synonymous amino acids is much smaller than if you just go through you go through mostly synonymous paths. So you expect a small value. In cases where, I hate to say selective pressure because it's not necessarily the case, but for instance, let's say if you can efficiently mutate and versus if you have to go, if you're forced to go through lots of non-synonymous cases.
Doesn't the interpretation of this for the R ORF one depends very much who you included in that? Because like, if you have different lineages, which are kind of basically two different R ORFs,
then you're
at a very high.
Sure, this is very crude, I would say, and basically,
It's quite funny that these numbers are basically the inverse of one each.
Thank you.
What's synonymous for one is not synonymous. I mean, if you forget about the second position.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really complementary.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah.
So it has to be like that. Right?
Okay. Well, that's.
That's why maybe it's more interesting to look at the second position because.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be exactly
you mean,
like that, does it?
You mean just restrict yourself to the second position?
It's exactly like that, because.
Well, there's a little bit going on in the first position too, right? And the third position are all silent. So.
Oh yeah. Basically, the third position is the first for the other, so...
But that's a crazy high number.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Because if it was just randomly scrambled, it should be around three or something.
Yes?
If you think about translation, have you ever looked at the two potential 5' untranslated regions? Whether the mRNA is capped or you have like internal ribosome entry sites in the two different strands.
I think Hannah has looked at that. I don't think I have a slide on that. Those untranslated regions are seem very conserved among the nanoviruses that have this ambigrammatic feature.
On both sides.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. We could talk about it later. I'm not sure exactly the consequence of that. What about this possibility? Protein product is irrelevant, or gumming up the works somehow, or even not synthesized. Well, this is This is not unprecedented, I would say, in some other viruses. There's a story about herpes virus, which I don't, I can't quite tell you correctly, I think. But it's a possibility. Another thing that's perhaps strong possibility is related to something called the nonsense-mediated decay. And in nonsense-mediated decay, this refers to what I called the cell's defenses for chopping up long single-stranded RNAs. If you could be antagonistic toward the nonsense-mediated decay pathway, then that would increase the stability of your viral RNA. So so if you could prevent the degradation of viral RNA, that would be another possibility. But that does not necessarily, this inhibition may not be related to protein product at all. For instance, you sit at ribosome, or you create long polysomes. You're effectively hiding the RNA sequence from things like this nonsense-mediated decay. So that's in the vein of gumming up the works, in other words.
Speaking of gumming up the works, if you had one messenger RNA that was being translated in both directions, you'd have ribosomes running into each other.
That's correct, yeah. Right, so we don't know what's the mechanics of actual translation. Do you, for instance, have something like a hairpin that makes this actually one RNA thing? That doesn't make, I don't know of any precedent for something like that, but you're exactly right. What's the mechanics of translating both strands? It's a big question mark. Are both nonavirus strains bound by ribosomes, right? That's exactly what the question is. There's some new data on ribosome profiling. I'm not an expert on this topic, and I have to just quote what I got from these two people. But was there another question before I go into this? Ribosome profiling is an offshoot of RNA sequencing where you actually dissolve all the messenger RNA that's not actively being protected by the ribosomes. And so you can make maps of footprints that is doing this over and over. You see where, in fact, the ribosomes are sitting at different times, let's say, in different different positions on the messenger RNA. And those are called footprints. This was done with a cell line, a derived cell line of Culex embryos. And this is how they do the sequencing. But here's the results for not the Narna gene, but a standard reference gene that people like to use called GAPDH. This is thought to be a housekeeping gene in many, many organisms. So if you just look at total RNA on this stretch and you compare it with where the start and the stop codons are for that gene, you'll see, in fact, all the RNA, not just the. This is not using the ribosome profiling. This is just using RNA sequencing. You'll see, in fact, that you can't really easily discern where the coding ends and where it begins. However, and also the reverse is shown here. There's nothing in the reverse direction. Okay? But this is not surprising. It's not a Narna virus gene. Okay, this is what you'd get for ribosome profiling for this reference gene. You get some bumps, but you get pretty good coverage over the whole open reading frame. And you could actually say what the, you know, do some measure of the average footprint size for that. Now do this for the Culex tarsalis infected cells. That's for the forward direction of the RDRP, that corresponds to the RDRP. That's what the footprints look like. Very different. So compare that with the, with the bottom frame there. So here you see, there's some variation depending on your position, but it's basically everywhere, maybe not at the same levels. And here it looks like it's all bunched up at different places, and there's kind of cityscape, looks like, or perhaps a traffic jam going on. Look at the reverse ORF, and you get a relatively small amount in the just the RNA sequencing compared to the forward, and something similar in the reverse ORF.
Greg, I don't understand that. For the RNA, these are short reads, right? So how can you... How can you assign them to the forward or the reverse? Because the short read is just going to look the same. Am I missing something?
Well, these are mapped onto the known sequence. So it's the...
Right, but the sequence of the... If you're mapping onto the sequence of the RNA, well, what's different about the forward direction versus the reverse direction?
Well, when you say short, I mean the it's not super short. It's these are protecting of order 40 to 50, maybe
so
more base
total
pair.
RNA.
Codons, right? Yeah. Say again.
Total RNA. Are those just RNA sequencing reads, or is this?
Yes. Yeah. No. That's just the. That's RNA. That's from RNA sequencing without the ribosome profile.
Right. So I'm just not understanding how you can have your read, and you can say it's mapping to the forward direction versus the reverse direction, because it's just, you know, it's going to be.
Well, short is what 140.
Yeah, but it's the same.
Independent of length, how do you map them to the forward and the reverse direction?
Isn't it just single stranded RNA?
You can't tell.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, you have 100 nucleotides.
Sorry.
Well, you're sequencing the CDNs, right? So you're sequencing in one direction.
Yeah. How can you tell? That's a great question. I'm not sure. I just saw this data, so that's a good point.
They're both coming out different strands.
Right? Yeah, I didn't.
I mean, that's a general question about ribosomal profiling.
Yeah, it is a. Yeah, I have to delve into how the sequencing is working here to answer that. Okay, but anyway, the point is here that you get very different results when you look at this particular gene and the reverse ORF than you do for a standard reference gene.
Do those peaks correspond to like poorly used codons?
I don't know. I haven't looked at the identity of the peaks with respect to the genome. That's a very good question, or a good point.
Does this mean it's double-stranded RNA?
There is double.
Because otherwise,
if you detect double-stranded RNA,
to go in the other direction for ribosomes.
But anyway, but like,
which is what this data shows.
There's some indications that double-stranded RNA is part of the life cycle of the RNA virus, but the frequency of it with respect to the single-stranded is, you know, it's like one to seven or something like that.
But the sequencing, you know,
I mean, that's
divided by green.
That's illustrated here.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so that data raises some questions. Where are those footprints located? Is it some kind of periodic phenomenon? What Hannah did, Hannah Ritalik took those plots and just put a lot of points where the peaks are and looked at the separations between those and found that, you know, there is a peak at about 32 nucleotide, but you know, there's also one at very small locations, which aren't shown here. But it's a big question mark, I would say. Okay, so there's a lot of questions. Most of them were asked, I think, in the talk. What's the function of the reverse open reading frame? What's the mechanics of actually, if these are translated, having ribosomes that move along both the forward and the reverse direction? How can the ORF increase the fitness or affect the fitness of the RNA virus? Stability of the viral RNA versus the nonsense mediated decay pathways? Surmise that you can make about whether which way transmission occurs? Is it just vertical? Is there also a horizontal modes? Why is the phenomenon not seen outside of the Narna Viridae? Is that just a question of we don't know enough about the world of viruses? Are there other ambigrammatic viruses? Is there a kind of an informatic lesson for the origins of new genes, the de novo origins of genes? Because this certainly suggests that if you want to remove stop codons, you could do it in a sequential way, or in a nearly sequential way in the reverse direction. More generally, if looking at these extreme examples points to any new biology, might, you know, occur at those extremes. Anyway, thanks for your attention, and I'll take more questions.
So, just thinking about the evolution of this, if you think about, if you have to get rid of 25 stop codons in order to get something that's functional, it's hard to figure out how that would ever happen, because if you get rid of one, you don't have function. Function. So it's essentially like acquiring 25 simultaneous mutations to get to something that
you're able to keep. So I focused on these obstructions and removing stops, but I didn't say anything about nucleotide substitutions in the forward that don't lead to a stop, right? There's plenty of those, right? So there's lots of. I take what you mean. If you don't have a functional polypeptide chain to begin with,
and you have to do so many things to get there.
Yeah.
That also seems very unlikely.
Well, I would, you know, this is not saying. This is not antagonistic toward the neutral theory, right? There's lots of neutral things going on.
I'm just marveling that it could happen.
Can I ask that please? From the other end, once you get it, it's also very easy to destroy it.
Yeah. Well, yes, it does seem to be unstable to the thing I drew on the board over there. Yeah.
Actually, seem to maintain that. So.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Yeah, well, presumably it's been around a long time, so it's a very interesting question.
So this nonsense mediated decay, if that's how it works, then you can imagine that removing every single like one less stop codon would give you some measurable enhancements in stability performance.
Yep.
So this way you can maybe imagine how it can put all this effort into removing them one by one, gaining a little bit.
That only works if you're actually translating in that direction.
Exactly. Right?
Well, you have to sit, a ribosome has to be sitting on you for that to.
But since there is an RNA polymerase.
If you attract, if you got a lot of ribosomes decorating you, you may not be translating if you're in a traffic jam, right? So it is, you can be in the act of translation with not require the protein.
But doesn't your
product, right?
RNA-seq data as well as the ribosome profile data indicate that the strand is degraded because it's tenfold lower?
And
maybe MMD or non-mediated K is the primary mechanism.
Yeah, it is of order tenfold lower, that's right. Yeah.
You might want to look at silhouettes.
Most
silhouettes only have one stop code on.
Yes.
Of course.
That's really interesting. Great. Yeah. Do you remember which codon table you're referring to for the psyllium?
There's a lot of genetic codes.
Yeah, you're saying one stop codon in that table. I'm familiar with the two stop tables.
Okay,
wasn't familiar with that. All right. All right, thanks everyone.